we're going to get moving on week two out of this three parts on Samson, aka Shimshon. Also, a heads up again that our next series will be with Rabbi Bergman in March, and his topic will be Maimonides and the Guide of the Perplexed. Those who are philosophically oriented should really enjoy that. In week one, we talked about Samson in terms of his military role. We asked whether he was a soldier or whether he was a renegade, and positioned him really as a unique savior for the Jews, as he was envisioned originally by Jacob and described in Jacob's blessing to the tribe of Dan. He fights solo. He fights on Philistine territory in a way that spares the Jews from having to fight, because the Jews, it seems, aren't ready for that. And the Jews turn around and make him their leader, as we saw last week. So this week, I want to look at another way in which Samson is unique. And that is that he has to be the least likely Nazirite ever. So in order to address that, we first need to know, what is a Nazirite? So I'll ask you the question. Can someone tell me what a Nazirite is?
Oh, you mean Nazir?
Nazir, nachon. Banglit, Nazirite. Ki'ilu.
Correct. A person who doesn't cut his hair, doesn't drink wine. Doesn't cut his hair.
Right. Doesn't cut his hair, doesn't drink wine. And what's the third thing?
Doesn't marry.
No, he can marry. And by the way, a Nazir can be a she also.
Okay. Service to God.
Nope, not service to God.
He doesn't shave his hair.
That we said. No cutting his hair, no drinking wine, and no coming in contact with the dead. That's the third, with dead human beings. That's the third. So I'm going to show you, first of all, where this comes from. If you look at the source sheet, and I posted the link a couple of times, I'm going to post it one more time here. If you take a look, first of all, at the top of the source sheet, I gave you two links. One is for recordings of classes I've given on the Book of Judges, which is where Samson's story appears, and there you can get much more depth on Samson. And then second, that's the collection of classes in this series. So if you go to that link, you'll get the recording from last week, and then once it's up, the recording from this week as well, and week three going forward. So if you take a look at source number one, this comes from the book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers. The parsha is Naso. Speak to the Israelites, God says to Moshe, to Moses, and this is the JPS English translation. Speak to the Israelites and say to them, if anyone, man or woman, explicitly utters a Nazirite's vow to set himself apart for the Lord, he shall abstain from wine and any other intoxicant. He shall not drink vinegar of wine or of any other intoxicant, neither shall he drink anything in which grapes have been steeped, nor eat grapes fresh or dried. Now, I'm leaving out the other intoxicant part of this, because that's actually its own discussion, and I don't want to get distracted into technical issues. But the point is, right now, he is not supposed to have grape products. Not grapes themselves. It's not just wine. Not grapes themselves. Not alcoholic, not alcoholic, doesn't make a difference. No grapes for the Nazirite. Throughout his term as Nazirite, he may not eat anything that is obtained from the grapevine, even seeds or skin. Throughout the term of his vow as Nazirite, no razor shall touch his head. It shall remain consecrated until the completion of his term as Nazirite of the Lord, the hair of his head being left to grow untrimmed. So that's number two. First, no grapes, no grape products. Second, no cutting his hair. Then, throughout the term that he has set apart for the Lord, he shall not go in where there is a dead person. Even if his father or mother, his brother or sister should die, he must not defile himself for them, since hair set apart for his God is upon his head. Throughout his term as Nazirite, he is consecrated to the Lord. So, you have number three. Bidyuk lo kmo kohen. Ruchama suggests a connection to the Kohen in the sense that a Kohen is not allowed to become impure. However, a Kohen does become impure for family members. In the event that a Kohen loses a family member, the Kohen does take care of the burial. So the Nazir here actually is stricter than the Kohen. Okay, Mark. Yes.
But this is not actually his case because he did not take Yavaga vow. This was at birth.
So we're going to talk about Samson specifically. Right now we're on Nazirites in general. We're going to get to the application to Samson. Yes, Susan.
Is a Nazirite, it says term. So it's not for life? Is it like he says, I want to be a Nazirite for 10 years or...
Good. So Nazirite is time defined. The Nazir is able to say, Nazir is the term in Hebrew. Nazirite is the clumsy English attempt to anglicize Nazir. But the term for a Nazirite is defined when you take the vow, when someone takes the vow. And in the event that someone doesn't specify a term, then it's 30 days by default. So, yeah.
It's not long term, it could be fairly short term.
Well, I don't know if it feels short to the Nazirite who's doing it, but yes.
No, it's not a lifetime.
It is not a life sentence, that is correct. Although, as noted, Samson is going to be unique and have his own conditions. Yes, Ian, you were going to say? I thought I heard you.
No, just stretching my arm.
Okay, Stephen, you were going to say? Somebody, I heard a male voice.
I was going to say that the choice can be to be a lifelong Nazir from the beginning, from the time the vow is taken. My question is, if that was chosen, if that's true, how would one get out of it?
So there's a whole ritual for the end of being a Nazirite, but if someone is doing it lifelong, then it's lifelong. There's only one way out of that. There is, on the other hand, for someone who becomes a Nazirite for life, there may be an option of an annual haircut. We're not really going to go there, though, right now. Diane, you were going to say?
I was going to ask that question about cutting hair. Can you start all over again and just not let your hair grow?
So if a Nazirite breaks the vow, then they start again. And indeed, they would. There's a whole ritual for that. Depending a little bit on how they broke it. There's one ritual if they became impure, they came in contact with the dead, as opposed to where they just, broke the terms of what they were supposed to do. They drank wine, they cut their hair. This is all, again, just general rules for a Nazirite. And now I want to take you to Samson. Take a look at source number 2. This is from the set of instructions that were given to Samson's mother, to Hatzalel Ponit, before she conceived Samson. Source number 2. An angel of the Lord, and again, we said last week, this is understood by most commentators, that the being who spoke to her was indeed an angel. There is a view also, though, that it was a prophet. Either way, some messenger of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "You are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Now be careful not to drink wine or other intoxicant or to eat anything unclean. For you are going to conceive and bear a son. Let no razor touch his head, for the boy is to be a Nazirite to God from the womb on. He shall be the first to deliver Israel from the Philistines." And we talked about last week, is he the first to deliver them, or he begins to deliver them? Different ways that you can translate the Hebrew. So here we get rudimentary instructions regarding Samson, meaning, out of the 3 rules that we just said, right, wine, impurity, and haircuts, how many of them were mentioned here? I'm just going to mute everybody by default because I'm getting background noise, but unmute to answer questions or to ask. How many out of those 3 were actually mentioned in this passage? So I'm seeing some people say 2 and some people say 1. It depends on who the address is. If you're talking about Samson, it only said 1, the haircut. If you're talking about for Samson's mother, she is given the rule also about wine and intoxicants, as well as anything unclean. I want to come back to the eating restriction for her in a little bit. But the whole idea that she has restrictions is in and of itself strange and something that we need to talk about. But I have a whole host of questions here. And in source number 3, I decided I was going to give you my questions, because there are just so many things here that require explanation. The first question I have there has nothing to do with Samson, but just to do with Nazirites in general. The Torah has rules for taking vows. Specifically, if a person takes a vow, they're obligated to fulfill it. Right? The Torah says that in a variety of different ways, but it says you have to keep your word. If you take a vow, whether it's a vow to do something, a vow not to do something, you're obligated to fulfill it. So really, the Torah didn't need an institution of Nazirite at all. Right? In other words, the Torah doesn't need to spell out all vows somebody might take. A person takes a vow and says they're going to not get a haircut, so they're not allowed to get a haircut. A person takes a vow that they're going to, I don't know, read a set of books, then they have to read a set of books. The Torah doesn't need to spell out each type of vow that a person might take. So my opening question is, why does the Torah create this separate institution of Nazirite? People make all sorts of vows that don't have a biblical template. People take on vows for fasting. That's not discussed in the Torah. That doesn't have its own set of rules. Why is it that that this vow should be presented in the Torah? So that's a question overall. Yes, Claudette.
Is it possible that these particular vows comes with a special blessing from God?
Possible, but the Torah doesn't say it does. It would be a nice idea, right? This has a special stamp because it appears in the Torah and it's unique. But we do say that while a person is observing this, they are to be sacred to God. And we have to come back to what that means. But on the face of it, I don't know why this should be, you know, different from anything else. It's a strange thing that this is here. Yes, Mickey and Phyllis, they've got their hand up.
Story if you don't know what a Nazirite is.
So that's an interesting idea, that the book of Numbers is giving us an introduction to the rules of being a Nazirite, setting the stage for what's going to happen with Samson. So that's a very interesting idea. That would create all sorts of challenges, meaning looking at the biblical text as setting the stage for the life of somebody who's not going to be around for centuries afterward. Would be, you know, somewhat challenging. It's not something we normally would see. That's not a reason to say it doesn't happen. The other point, though, is that Samson is not the only Nazirite found in Tanakh. We have others. For example, Absalom, David's son, was a Nazirite. So there are others who take this on. It's not a sort of a private thing. Now, you could say, well, okay, then it's setting the stage for the other Nazirites. Let it be setting the stage for more of them. But that just pushes the question further. I see your hand, Arthur. That just pushes the question further of why should we have such an institution? And now, why do we see celebrities in Tanakh, in fact, carrying it out? What is the magic, so to speak, of being a Nazirite? Arthur, yeah. And then Linda. Arthur, you're muted. You're muted, Arthur. I can't hear you. Still not.
Hold on.
There you
go.
Okay,
can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Shimshon never took the vows of the Nazirite.
Good.
They were imposed on him before he was born.
You are quite correct.
Seed.
Right.
So, it indicates in the text you've given us, he's to be a Nazirite to God from womb on.
Yep.
Which means forever.
You got it. We're gonna come to this. We're getting there. We're not there yet, but both points that you raise are indeed points we have to address. He never takes this on, and it is from the womb. It's from the very beginning. Samson is gonna be unique, as we're going to see. I see Gloria's note, but I was going to hear from Linda first. I'm going to take Linda, I'll look at Gloria's note, and then Elaine has her hand up. Yes, but you're right, Arthur. Yeah.
I think it's that God is trying to discourage this type of dedication. And because of that, he's putting very restrictive limits on it. just like slavery. I mean, slavery is in the Bible, but there are so many restrictions for the owner of the slave, and I think it sort of falls into the same category.
Ah, interesting. So the idea may be to regulate something that people were going to take on. Since people have an instinct for this, and we're going to have to talk about why they have an instinct for it, the Torah does this in order to put it in a box, so to speak, and say, okay, fine, if you're going to do this, here's the way to do it. That's a fascinating idea, which I think it is worth exploring. You're right, certainly, that we see it in the context of slavery as well. I want to think that through a little bit more, but I like the idea. Thank you. Gloria writes in the chat, other nations had similar ideas, but as part of idol worship, it was actually considered a sin to be a Nazirite. He had to bring a sin sacrifice when done. So we're going to talk about that. Is it actually a good thing to be a Nazirite at all? Is something that we want to come back to. But this is sort of along the lines of where Linda is going about regulating it and directing it in a particular way. Elaine.
It's a way of self-control.
Mm-hmm. Right, so presenting it as a method of self-control is appealing when you talk about the drinking part. It's harder to sustain when you talk haircuts, although you can still make that work, as we'll see. But it's really hard when you talk about not being in touch with the dead. Like, what? Where does that fit into this picture? It's the total picture of the Nazirite that becomes difficult. Let's go a little further, because there's a lot to talk about here. In terms of my second question in number three, why would anyone become a Nazirite? Self-control may well be the motivation. Dedication to God may be another motivation. We've said, the text says, he is dedicated to God, he's holy to God. So that's a possibility. Another question, why would God make Samson a Nazirite? What's the goal? So logically, I would come back and say, it's the self-control point, right? It's... he's a guy who we know, we already saw last week. He's a passionate person. He's involved with the women of the Philistines. He's forever taking revenge and destroying things. So maybe it's a self-control thing. But that leads me to ask the next question, which is, does Samson succeed as a Nazirite? Does he actually succeed? Moish.
I'd like to offer something different. I think it's a Brad Pitt moment. He's what he's trying to do is to be a movie idol or an idol to the people at a time when they needed him, and that's why the gentleman raised a perfect question. How can he be a Nazir when somebody imposes on him? The point was, God saying, your role is to be a movie idol. And in that way to be a model, not a role, a general role model, but a specific.
So, Moish is along the lines of the title of where we're going with this, restraint or role model. You see it at the top of the sheet. So I don't want to ask him too many questions. But I am curious, how does someone become a role model by not cutting his hair? You have to keep in mind, not cutting your hair in biblical times is different from not cutting your hair now, right? Not cutting your hair now, but you can shampoo it every morning and you can style it and do whatever you like with it. That can look very nice. Not cutting your hair in biblical times is gross. It makes you repellent.
If you think of any biblical movie you've seen, and pretty well any movie Brad Pitt's been in, that's the answer to your question.
Sorry, that's the number of movies I've seen that Brad Pitt has been in, I think, is somewhere between zero and zero, I think.
You're lost. But,
yes.
No, but the point is, that's a look. That's a look that attracts. That's why I think it is.
Okay. I still think that the hair thing is going to be a non-starter for a lot of people. But let me ask the question. Does Samson succeed as a Nazirite? Let's go down the list of things he has to observe. Okay? No grape products, no wine. So we don't ever see Samson explicitly drinking. However, take a look at source number 4. From his marriage to his first Philistine woman, His father comes to town, right? Samson wants his father to arrange the marriage. So his father came down to the woman, and Samson made a feast there, as young men used to do. When they saw him, they designated 30 companions to be with him. He's at the party, and he's got these 30 guys who are his fellows he's with, and you remember the story because we talked about it last week. He gives them a riddle, and they can't figure out the riddle. There's a week-long festival going on, and he's there in the middle of it. Did he drink? Maybe. It was a pretty wild wedding party. It resulted in a lot of people getting killed. But no, we don't know for sure that he drank. I can't say one way or the other. Just because he's at a party doesn't mean he drank, although it's a bad idea for Nazarites to go to parties. That's for sure. Haircut? Samson? Yeah. He ends up losing the hair. So that's a no-no. Contact with the dead? I mean,
at the party.
Beginning at the party, and then at every party afterwards. I mean, he's constantly killing people.
All the animals were dead animals.
Well, that's why I stressed before, it's dead people specifically. It's not about dead animals. He hasn't become a vegetarian. It's only dead people, but he's got a lot of dead people around. I mean, he's up close and personal. Jawbone of the donkey, the whole bit. So it's hard to see Samson succeeding in this regard. Not to mention, we said in source number one that he's supposed to be sacred to God. Is that what comes to mind when you look at Samson's career, the Philistine women he's involved with? This doesn't look like sacred to God. So this idea that Samson is a Nazarite in order to achieve some kind of a goal leads me to think maybe you needed a plan B. Because it hasn't seemed to succeed. And then, the last question in my set of questions in number three, is he a Nazarite at all? And already, Mark pointed out, and Arthur pointed out, that the answer may be no. Because, go back to source number one, how do you become a Nazarite? It says it.
Take a vow.
Yeah, you take a vow. Anyone, man or woman, explicitly utters a Nazarite's vow. And there's a lot of discussion in the Talmud about that explicitly utters thing. You have to be crystal clear when you say it. There's a lot of discussion about that. Yes, Diane.
Samson didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
He was born a Nazarite.
He has no choice at all. So much so that the Talmud in the volume called Nazir has a discussion of whether Samson was a Nazarite at all. Take a look at source number five, where you get Maimonides summarizing his conclusions from that Talmudic passage. Maimonides writes, Samson was not a full Nazarite, which is kind of shocking, because you just, like, that's what you always think. Samson, of course he's a Nazarite. He's not a full Nazarite, for he did not vow to be a Nazarite, just like we've said. But the malach, this messenger, angel, prophet, whatever this was, separated him from ritual impurity, said, don't be in contact with the dead. What was his law? So what were the rules for Samson? He was prohibited from wine, and prohibited from shaving, and permitted to become ritually impure for the dead. He's actually allowed to become impure. This is halacha, it's the law by tradition. Even though it seems so counterintuitive, nonetheless, that's the way it works, so much so that Maimonides continues. Therefore, one who says, I am a Nazarite like Samson, if someone actually says they want to be like him, such a person is a Nazarite from shaving and wine forever, for life. No shaving, no wine. He does not shave every 12 months like other eternal Nazarites. Remember, we asked the question of whether someone can get a haircut if they become a Nazarite for life. The answer is, unless they're like Samson, yes. They can do it once a year, but not him. Samson cannot. He may become ritually impure for the dead. One who vows to be a Nazarite like Samson cannot repeal his vow. For the period of being a Nazir, a Nazarite of Samson, was eternal. And what he's saying here is, normally, there's a rule when it comes to taking vows. There are ways that vows can be undone. if someone takes a vow and comes to regret it because of something they could not have foreseen, then they can go to a rabbinical court and get the vow repealed. So, classic example. Somebody takes a vow that he's not going to shower. Then he finds out after a couple of days that he has no friends. So he's able to go to the rabbinical court and say, you know, I didn't realize that that was going to be a result of this. And based on that, they can repeal the vow. He's saying here, there's no repealing a vow to be a Nazirite like Samson, because Samson has no options. Samson has no out. His Nazirism is unusual, which leads us to ask, so now I really don't understand. He is a Nazirite, but he's not a Nazirite. He's got two out of three rules. No wine, no shaving, but yes, contact with the dead. What is he, Ian?
Well, and also, he's not supposed to eat grapes. And when he's at a festivity like his marriage, I would assume for 7 days there's a table or a bowls with grapes in it.
Right. And that was part of my problem. Like, what's he doing at that feast? As a matter of fact, you remember we referred last week to the part of the story where he kills a lion, right? He fights with a lion, he kills the lion. So in that story, he starts out with his parents. But his parents, this occurred on the road to his first Philistine wife. So he's on the way to see her, and he's with his parents, and then suddenly he has this encounter with the lion, and his parents aren't there. The text says this was outside the vineyards of the area. And so the sages suggest maybe he actually avoided the vineyard, knowing he's not supposed to eat grapes. He avoided the vineyard. They went straight to the town through the vineyard. He went a different route. He went around, and that's where he met the lion. That's one possible point, but it just, I relate that to what Ian is saying. Like, sitting around at a festival for 7 days is a bad way to conduct yourself as a Nazirite. It doesn't really seem very smart. Not that smart ranked really high on the traits that we saw last week, as Abarbanel noted. Nonetheless, Susan.
Is it possible if we're assuming it's an angel, and remember yesterday we talked about decrees not being able to be changed if they're a decree that's made?
Yeah.
But can Hashem change a decree? Can he then, like, if he sent the angel to tell Samson that this is his role, so he doesn't take the vow, but Hashem took it for him, then is that different than, because nobody, all the other Nazirs have to be taken on themselves, but no other Nazir is compared to being appointed by God.
Right. So the answer is God can undo whatever God wants. I mean, that's part of the job description of being God.
What?
God can undo whatever God wants, but as a general principle, when God creates a rule, not only are we supposed to be bound by it, but God is supposed to be bound by it. We don't like the idea of God breaking God's own rules. That's not something that's supposed to happen. Paul notes in the chat that Samson's primary role was not to be a Nazirite, but to deliver Israel from the Philistines, or to begin to deliver them. And that's certainly true, but that just forces the question, why be a Nazirite at all? So here's what I want to do. What we've established so far is a set of rules that are given to Samson and questions about why. But I started out by pointing out that it's not just Samson, it's his mother who has these rules as well. And I want to go back to the dialogue between this messenger of God and Samson's mother first. I want to look at that. Then I want to understand Samson's process of being a Nazirite using the conventional model of what a Nazirite is. The idea that it's in fact for restraint purposes, and see whether it fits his story. And then I want to look at it in a very different way. And that's the role model idea that we're going to get to, which will ultimately lead us into week 3. But let's get started by looking again at that conversation between Samson's mother and this being. And specifically, not the conversation part, but the instructions that she receives. So if you look back at source number 2, and I put the link in the chat again for the source sheet because a couple of people have joined in. So back in source number 2, this being appears to her and says to her, "You are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son, and you don't drink wine or any intoxicant," and so on. Notice here the way that they word it. "You shall conceive and bear a son." In the Hebrew, it's at hara, hey resh hey. That is the word for conception. But the truth is it's vague. You could read it as at hara, you have already conceived, meaning you're already pregnant. Or, the way JPS renders it, you are going to conceive. If this is, in fact, before she has conceived, or even if not, she's already pregnant, why is it that she should have to observe these rules? Meaning, Samson's not even born yet. Like, it's one thing to say, well, you know what, he's going to have restrictions, so therefore we want his mother to carry out the restrictions also, and that way it'll be easier for him. He's not even born yet. What is the message in having her do this? Yes, Jeanette.
I'm thinking that the Torah is trying to tell us that a mother can influence her child even in the womb. That there are things she can do and say that will impact on the child.
Right. So one possibility is, indeed, what she does could influence. Somebody looking at this beforehand commented to me by email before the class that it's very prescient here, the idea of recognizing that a mother drinking alcohol while pregnant can influence the baby in the uterus. I think if it were actually giving us medical advice, though, it would have commanded it for everybody, not just for Samson's mother. Nonetheless, yes, good advice. Myrna notes in the chat that, you know, this really does sound like a sort of seed story for the Christian model. The truth of the matter is, though, you don't need to go to Samson's story for that. Meaning, you have plenty of biblical accounts of mothers who are told beforehand, you know, you're going to become pregnant and you're going to have a child, and what the child's going to be. The only thing that's added here, I suppose, is the level of restrictions for her, which could be understood as a statement of you will influence your child even in utero. It could be understood as a statement of purity. You have to be pure for his sake so that he won't be contaminated by whatever you absorb. There are a lot of ways that you can take it. Moish, briefly.
Okay, I think the sublime message here is very simple. After almost 200 years of being in the land, they're bored. All of the Jews are bored. They're not excited. I'm serious. And so what do? The mother gets the story of Sarah, his maiden, and he's going to be a Nazir, and we're all waiting for him. And that's all it is. It's like a movie.
The problem that you have is, again, it's not, you haven't yet explained how this is going to work as a model for them. And Sarah, the story of Sarah doesn't involve any Nazirism.
No, it's not going to work as a model. That's the literary beauty of it. But for the moment, it's going to work.
Okay.
It's going to end with the Temple of Doom and goodbye story, and Shimshon is really this Brad Pitt. That's really all we know about. Like you said, it's him.
All right. Hang in there, Moish.
Okay.
So she is told not to drink any wine or, as they put it here, other intoxicants, whether that really refers to other intoxicants or just wine. Again, I said I'm not discussing. She is also told not to eat anything that is ritually impure. And that's actually problematic because we don't know what ritually impure means. What is this restriction for her? If you mean things that aren't kosher, why is she getting special instructions of don't eat treif? Right? That's true in general for us. We're not supposed to eat non-kosher. So the Talmud discusses this, and in source number 6, Rabbi Yitzchak makes a suggestion that she is being told, don't eat anything that he's not allowed to eat. whatever he's not supposed to eat, you shouldn't eat. There are some challenges with the text I'm not going into right now, but she has to follow restrictions that he has to follow. And I think that there are two reasons for her to receive this instruction. Number one, her act of preparation is an act of personal holiness. And this speaks to why one becomes a Nazir at all. We said back in source number one, if you look at the last line of that, we said that throughout his term as Nazirite, he is consecrated to the Lord. In the Hebrew, Kadosh Hu Lashem. There is an element of holiness associated with the Nazirite, and not just in that original biblical text in source number one, but in Tanakh in general, in scripture in general. Take a look at source number seven, please. Amos, the prophet Amos, predicts, "And I will establish from your children prophets and from your youths Nazirites." It's a promise for the future to elevate the spiritual level of our children, and the parallel is between prophets and Nazirites. Prophets, clearly people who have a close relationship with God. And Nazirites as well, then, are people who have that kind of relationship with God. And if you take a look in source number 8, I brought you a midrash, which says it specifically. Because he, the Nazirite, vowed for a life of separation and purity, he is called holy. The verse even gauges him to be as a prophet, that verse in Amos that we just read. And that brings me to something that was mentioned earlier, that now I'm going to get a chance to unpack. I forget who it was who said it, but somebody commented about the Nazirite bringing a sin offering. So, a Nazirite, I think it was Esther who said it. So the Nazirite, at the end of the period of being a Nazirite, brings certain karbanot, brings certain sacrifices. One set of sacrifices if the Nazirite fails and becomes impure, and then a separate set of sacrifices where the Nazirite actually completes the term. But one of the sacrifices that the Nazirite brings is called in Hebrew a chatat. We understand chatat to mean a sin offering, right? That's how we usually understand it. Leading the Talmud to ask a question. Why is a Nazirite bringing a sin offering? What sin has the Nazirite committed? That's a major, major question. So there is a view in the Talmud that says the Nazirite has sinned by paining himself by not drinking wine. God created you, gave you this world, allowed you certain pleasures, and you restricted yourself and said, I'm not going to engage in these pleasures. That's not fair. God said, I want you to engage in them, so you engage in them. You don't say, I'm going to now cause myself pain. And that's one view brought in the Talmud. What's the weakness of that view? What's the problem with that view that he sinned by restricting himself from wine?
Because God told him to do it, so he's not part of his...
Well, that's true for Samson. That's true for Samson. I'm talking about it for general Nazirites who take these vows on themselves. But that's if you choose. That's your choice. No one forced you to become a Nazirite. It's if you take a vow.
So it's the choosing of being a Nazirite, basically.
But my question is, do you really think that Judaism is saying, that the Torah is saying, that because you refrained from some form of permitted pleasure, you've sinned? I mean, there are all sorts of pleasures that God prohibits for us. And there is within Judaism a concept of taking on fasts, granted that not everybody does it, and it has to be done in certain ways, but it's hard to tell me, like those of you who were with us a few months ago when we learned about Rabbi Yosef Karo and his asceticism, right? I pointed out then, there's a lot within Judaism that supports the idea of saying, I don't want to engage in a particular pleasure, I don't want to engage in a particular pleasure right now. Others disagree in the Talmud itself and say it's not a sin offering at all. The different offerings are named based on what they're usually used for. The Nazirite needs to bring an offering as part of ending the period of being a Nazirite, it looks like a sin offering because the rituals that are performed are the same as for sin offerings, but it's not actually about any sin at all. It's simply a pro forma ritual. That's a second approach. But take a look at source number 9, where I bring you Nachmanides. And Nachmanides has a strong insight into this that demonstrates the holiness of the Nazirite. He says, the reason a Nazirite brings a chatat, this sin offering, when he completes his period of being a Nazir is not explained. The text doesn't say why. On a simple level, he causes himself to transgress when he completes his period of being a Nazirite, for now he is separated in his holiness and his service of God. Meaning, as a Nazirite, he's separated from everybody else. And it will be appropriate for him to maintain this separation forever and remain for his entire life a Nazirite, sacred to God. And so he needs atonement when he returns to contaminate himself with the desires of this world. In other words, the Nazirite is dedicated to God, and how dare you stop being a Nazirite? Who gave you the right to stop being a Nazirite? Who gave you the right that you should just walk away from it? You need to recognize you started something and now you're stepping away from it. So that is what Nachmanides sees here. It is a ritual to conduct for taking himself away from the holy level that he originally had. So my point in bringing you this is not so much to discuss the laws of the Nazirite, as interesting as those are, but to say the Nazirism state is a state of dedication to God. Samson's mother enters it, and then Samson himself is going to enter it. One other aspect to this, just briefly, is that having his mother do it highlights the idea that Samson has been chosen for a special role. The fact that his mother is doing this before he's even born, before he's even conceived, has him being born into this template. So there is holiness associated with being a Nazirite, and that is supposed to do something for Samson. And now we have to ask the question, what exactly is this holiness supposed to do? Samson is going to be dedicated as holy. His mother has dedicated him as holy. What in the world is this about? So the conventional story is what we said in the beginning. The conventional story is a Nazirite needs to learn restraint. That's why you become a Nazirite. And if you take a look at two sources from the Talmud that I bring you here, in sources 10 and 11, you get that very clearly. Source number 10 first talks about the case of a sota. Can someone tell me what the case of the sota is? Briefly.
The woman who's suspected of
adultery.
Well,
right.
But we don't have proof. We have scenes. We have witnesses that she went after being warned not
right.
to
adultery
with a.
Right. So those are the statement that it's adultery or that there's something are all sort of true. The case of the sota is a case in which a man and a woman a man and a married woman engaged in something inappropriate, and the only question is how far did they go? Meaning, we know that they were alone together, which is already prohibited, and the question is, what happened when they were alone? And we have no way to determine that. And so the Torah gives you a way to deal with it. It's the opposite of the classic trial by ordeal. It's the opposite of that. Meaning, in a case of trial by ordeal, right, if you're familiar with the concept, Stephen, I see your hand, but I'm going to ask you to hold on. In the case of classic trial by ordeal, you assume somebody is guilty, and you put them in a situation where they're going to suffer unless a miracle saves them. And if a miracle happens, I guess they're innocent. So you put somebody in a fire, you throw them in a river, that's a trial by ordeal. You don't have such a concept in Judaism, but what you have is the reverse. They have the sota drink a potion of water, as well as they take a text of the Torah that describes the laws of the Sotah. And they scrape the text, the ink from it, into the water. So she's drinking the portion of the Sotah, so to speak. And if she's innocent, she'll be fine. Nothing happens when you drink water with a little bit of ink in it. However, if she's guilty, then there will be this miraculous punishment. And also, the text describes blessings come to her if she's innocent and so on. I'm not making this a whole class about Sotah. That would be a fun discussion. Susan, you're talking about possible topics for the future. That is a fun topic. That's one we could spend an hour or three on. But the point for us right now is that this story of the Sotah begins with a man and a married woman who were alone together, such that something might have happened, and we don't know what happened and what didn't happen. Rose asks in the chat, what is punishment to the man? And the answer is that just like she has this supernatural punishment happen to her, the Talmud records that the same thing happened to the man. He's not drinking. It just happens to him in the same way that whatever happens to her is miraculous divine intervention. It happens to him as well. So the description biblically of the stomach bloating and all of that happens to him too. We have no recorded cases of Sotah, interestingly. We don't actually have, as far as I can recall, a recorded case of this actually, you know, occurring with the description of, and this is what happened. There's even debate as to when the ritual would have stopped. Would it have existed in the Second Temple period? When in the Second Temple period? That's its own discussion. Stephen, you've been waiting very patiently.
So, in the case of Pinchas,
that's not a Sotah case.
It's this case of sexual
immorality, right? But that's not Sotah at all. In Pinchas's case, they knew exactly what happened because it was done in public in front of everybody.
Yes, and. Is the halacha not that? Is the halacha that that to be convicted, the two witnesses must.
You're blipping in and out.
Must see the act.
So. I can't hear you well. Your internet connection seems to be going in and out, but unless it's my connection. But the answer to your question is this. You're mixing three different things. The Sotah case, there are no witnesses beyond the fact that we know that the man and woman were alone together. If we had witnesses, you wouldn't need the whole Sotah ritual. In a normal case, you have a set of witnesses and a warning and a cross-examination of the witnesses. That's the way things normally happen, where there are witnesses to an act. And then you have Pinchas's story, where the act is going on in front of the entire nation, and that's a thing unto itself. That's sui generis. It's not comparable to any other case. But I bring you all of the discussion of Sotah in source number 10, because the Talmud notes that the stories of the Nazirite and the Sotah are placed side by side in the biblical text. If you were to read Parshat Naso, Numbers, chapter 6, you would find the two stories are side by side, the Sotah and the Nazirite. So the Talmud says, why are these two things side by side? It doesn't make any sense. Meaning, if you actually open up that Torah portion, those stories aren't like in a context where they make sense to be there. They must have been put together for a reason. So the Talmud says, yeah, there is a reason. Why are the portions of the Nazirite and the Sotah juxtaposed? To teach you that all who see the Sotah in her corruption, in what happens to her, should vow distance from wine. The Nazirite sees what happened, that this man and woman got together and all that, and he should be motivated to swear off wine and to say, you know what? I need to make sure I get under control. I can't ever let that be me. So this presents the picture of the Nazirite as a function of restraint, personal restraint. I have an issue. I am afraid I'm going down a dangerous path. Let me stop myself before I end up in trouble. Clear? Now take a look at source number 11. Source number 11 gives us an actual case of a Nazirite. Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Righteous. said the following, and we know historically he lives relatively early on in the Second Temple period. So you're talking somewhere around, depending a little bit on how you do the chronology, somewhere around the 4th century before the Common Era. He says, I never ate the guilt offering of a Nazarite who had become ritually impure but once. Okay? Meaning, there's an offering brought by a Nazarite who makes a mistake. A person says he's going to become a Nazarite and then becomes impure. Something happened. He has to bring certain offerings. And you eat from the offering. A Kohen, a priest, gets to eat from the offering. And he says, I never ate. I didn't want anything to do with that. But one time I did. Once a Nazarite came from the south, and I saw that he was of beautiful eyes, a handsome appearance, and long braided hair. I asked him, what made you decide to destroy this beautiful hair? Now, when he says destroy, there are two possibilities for what he means. One possibility is just that as it grows long, but the other possibility is that because when one concludes being a Nazarite, if you go back to Numbers chapter 6, you'll see it there, you actually cut off all of the hair. So you spent all that time growing it, and then you destroy it. Yes. Susan, all of it. That's correct. So, so maybe he's saying to him, like, you grew all this hair, and now you're going to have to destroy it. So he says, what made you do that? Shimon asks. He told me. Following story. I was a shepherd for my father in my town, and I went to draw water from the spring, and I saw my reflection. My yetzer. Yetzer is a term that doesn't have a good English translation. Call it natural inclination if you like, but that really doesn't do the job. But my yetzer became agitated and sought to draw me from the world, which either means to kill himself. He saw his beauty, he admires his beauty, he's so enamored of it, and he realizes it's going to disappear one day, and he wants to end his life. Or, alternatively, what he means is to leave the world, meaning the world of righteousness, to cause me to go sin. He sees how beautiful he is, and how attractive he is, and he knows that he has avenues that are open to him to do something inappropriate. Either way, I told it, he says, I said to myself, wicked one, why are you arrogant about a world that is not your own, with one who will be decay and worms? He says, come on. In the end, it all rots. Why are you trying to draw me from this world? Why are you trying to draw me into sin? By the temple service, he swears, by God, essentially. There's a lot to say about the oath, but I'm not going into it right now. I will shave you off for the sake of heaven. He's so enamored of his hair, he says, I'm going to get rid of it. Which answers the question, I guess, about what he meant about destroying his beautiful hair. He meant shaving it off at the end. So Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Righteous, says, I immediately stood and kissed him on his head, and I said, my son, may there be more Nazarites like you in Israel. That's the kind of Nazarite we need, says Shimon HaTzadik.
Wait.
Yes.
Excuse me, can I just ask? But he doesn't destroy, unless I'm reading it incorrectly, he has long braided hair. He braids it. He doesn't cut it.
Right, so that was what I said before, that at the end of the period of being a Nazarite, you have to cut off all the hair. So he goes through a period of growing it, and then he's going to have to destroy it.
But when he meets Shimon, he still has his hair, even
right.
though he's already looked in his reflection and seen how gorgeous he is.
Right, so what happens is he saw how gorgeous he was. That made him decide that he's going to take on a vow, which will necessitate that when he completes the vow, which he hasn't done yet, he's going to cut off all the hair. In other words, Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Righteous, is at the temple site. This fellow shows up, and he has to bring his offerings because he blew it midway through his Nazarism, and now he has to start again. But part of his ritual is going to be to cut off all of his hair.
But if you're a Nazarite, you're not allowed to cut your hair.
At the end of the period of being a Nazarite, you're required to. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's not in the verses. I didn't bring you the whole portion of the laws from Numbers chapter 6, but if you take a look there, you'll see that at the end of being a Nazarite, you're actually required to cut off all of the hair.
Okay.
So
unless you're going to be a Nazarite for life, right?
Correct. Correct. That's correct. Yeah. I just pulled out my Tanakh so I can give you the specific reference. If you take a look in Numbers chapter 6, sentence 18, that's where you'll find it. V'gilach ha-nazir petach o'al moed et rosh nizro. The Nazarite shaves off at the entrance to the tabernacle the hair that he's been growing. So it's Numbers 6:18 for those who want to look it up.
Thank you.
Sure. But there is a very interesting problem with this story. Mickey, you raise your hand. Yes.
I saw that he was of beautiful eyes, a handsome appearance, and so on. Is that a code of some kind?
What do you mean?
Is it possible that he was a homosexual?
Oh, that's an interesting idea. I can't think... I thought you were going to ask me something different about it, because you actually use these terms of specifically the hair being long and braided like this. In Tanakh, in biblical text, as well as in the Talmud, to describe a sort of angelic beauty. In the Talmud, it's used with a particular sage, Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, who was being held prisoner by the Romans when he was a child. And he is described with this beauty. But I think also in the book of Daniel, this comes up. And it's even used as a description for God. For those who go to a synagogue where they do the song Anim Zimirot, so these words in the Hebrew Kvutzotav Tal Talim should be familiar. It's used there in a description of God. I don't know about the homosexual idea. That I have not seen. It's a very interesting idea. I would be a little surprised to see it in the Talmud. Even in code. It's not exactly a text that's promoting that. So I would feel like that would be an odd find. But it's an interesting suggestion. So the thing that I was expecting someone to ask, anybody here familiar with the story of Narcissus? Yeah? Take a look at source number 12, courtesy of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
That's exactly the same story.
Well, except the ending is different. Take a look at source number 12. Narcissus, in Greek mythology, the son of the river god Cephissus and the nymph Liriope, or Liriope, I don't know. He was distinguished for his beauty. According to Ovid's Metamorphoses, Book 3, Narcissus' mother was told by the blind seer Tiresias that he would have a long life, provided he never recognized himself. So there's a case of somebody being told something by their mother. However, his rejection of the love of the nymph Echo, or in an earlier version of the young man Amenaeus, there you go, Mickey, drew upon him the vengeance of the gods. He fell in love with his own reflection in the waters of a spring and pined away, or killed himself. The flower that bears his name sprang up where he died. So, the story that the Talmud is telling, but again, keep in mind, the Talmud is, even though Simon the Righteous, Shimon HaTzadik, would have been before the Greeks, but the story the Talmud is recording in Greco-Roman times is a repudiation of the Narcissus story. The Narcissus story, he ends up taking his own life, or he dies. In the Talmud's version of it, he gets himself under control and becomes a Nazarite. So it's it's going the other direction. But what these stories clearly convey to us, and I see it's 11, just turned 11, so we're going to have to continue with this next time. But what these stories convey to us is the idea that the Nazarite is meant to gain control of oneself. There's a feeling of lack of self-control, and seeing what that lack of self-control does to others. And so the Nazarite is going to stay away from that which could cause them to find the same end. If you look at source number 13, I brought you the Sefer HaChinuch with its description of the mitzvah of the Nazarite. The motivation is to stay away from the mundane. In a sense, one makes oneself a sacrifice to God. They're taking a vow to God, making themselves a sacrifice. So there's a lot more to say about this, but what we're going to have to do next time is ask, so does the model of restraint work as a description of Samson's career? And if not, how else should we look at him? And then we'll move from that into the week 3 topic to talk about the ways in which Samson functions as a role model for the Jews. But what I hope is clear so far, and I hope we understand from what we did today, is that Samson is a Nazarite, but an unusual form of the Nazarite. His mother is already in this mold. She's told to keep it. And there's some element of dedication to God that's meant to play out in his career. That's what I wanted to show here. So stay tuned, come back next week, and we'll talk about it more. Someone just sent me a message in the chat, which I'll answer for those who want to stick around, those who need to go, by all means. Someone sent me a message asking, are there Nazirim in our time? So being a Nazir is very, very discouraged because you can't end it now. Because you can't bring the... Hang on, Ruchama, Rakshniya, Aniyodeya, Rakshniya. You're not supposed to become a Nazir because you can't end it by bringing the sacrifices that are necessary. So you'll be restricted to just observing Nazirism forever. However, there was a famous rabbi who was a student of Rabbi Cook in Israel, who became known as the Nazir. He took the vow of being a Nazir and lived it. So there have been those who have done it. It is technically binding. It's an extraordinarily bad idea. But yes, it indeed can happen. I'm going to stick around for questions and comments, for a few minutes, but, thank you very much.
Okay. I